course, when I was talking about the Islamophobia cases, you know, yes. Islamophobic cases that happened after that, you know, event in America, and
Iran's deputy foreign minister tells Press TV the Islamic Republic has informed the International Atomic Energy Agency it is beginning 60% uranium enrichment and will introduce 1,000 new centrifuges in Natanz.
Unrest flares up between police and protesters in the U.S. city of Portland after the police killing of a black man in Minnesota. China urges the United States to refrain from playing with fire on the issue of Chinese Taipei. Welcome to World News from our Tehran headquarters with me, Behrouz Najef. It's good to have you with us. In an exclusive interview with Press TV, Iran's top nuclear negotiator says that the country will start 60% uranium enrichment as of Wednesday. Abbas Araghchi, who also serves as Iranian deputy foreign minister, said that Tehran has informed the International Atomic Energy Agency about the decision.
On nuclear developments, yesterday we send a letter to the agency that we are going to add 1,000 more centrifuges to Natanz facility. That is in addition to the current numbers, current number of machines. And also today, we just send a new letter to the agency saying that we would start from tomorrow enrichment up to 60%, and that is for Iran needs to produce certain radio isotopes needed for, you know, certain medical treatments. The letter and the DIQ has been sent today to the agency, and we would start this important job from tomorrow. Obviously, this is certainly according to our needs and in line with our NPT commitments. In response to the attack to Natanz facility, as I said, we have already announced more 1,000 centrifuges. We are going to introduce to Natanz, and also we are going to, do 60% enrichment. Also, Natanz would be, filled with, or actually the damaged centrifuges in Natanz, which I don't know the exact number, would be replaced with more advanced centrifuges and more capable centrifuges. The same IR-1, but advanced IR-1 centrifuges. So in fact, the incident in Natanz, or the better to say the terrorist attack to Natanz, would help Iran's nuclear or enrichment capability and capacity go even beyond, you know, the current situation. So in fact, we are now in a much better situation. In the coming weeks, everything would be go back to normal in Natanz, in much better condition, with more capable centrifuges and with more number of centrifuges. So we are not going to lose anything in that regard.
We've heard from Western media reports on the attack on Natanz that it would take at least 9 months for Iran to go back to where it was before this attack. What can you tell us about that?
Well, they will see that. They will see how fast we go back into even a better situation.
Well, our Vienna correspondent Hamal Ezgi says that under the 2015 deal, Iran has the right to take remedial measures following the U.S. withdrawal of the agreement and the imposition of sanctions.
As Mr. Araghchi put it, Iran is moving in two directions. One is continuing with this process of negotiation, the discussions that are taking place in the context of the Vienna talks, and on the other side, taking these nuclear actions, taking these increased remedial measures in response to what's happening. So I guess what happened in Natanz triggered this. We saw that the centrifuges there were damaged. Now Mr. Arakshi is saying that it's not just going to only replace those damaged centrifuges, but it is actually going to introduce an additional 1,000 new centrifuges, and that the IR-1 centrifuges that it is replacing for those that have been damaged are going to be more advanced than those that were already there. And also introducing the enrichment of 60%. This is quite huge when it comes to the level of Iran's nuclear activities and how the country has been going over and beyond its JCPOA obligations. And Tehran has always made it clear that it believes these actions are not unlawful because the Articles 26 and 36 of the JCPOA give Iran the right to take these remedial measures following the withdrawal of the U.S. in 2018 and following the imposition of what Iran and also an other JCPOA participants describe as unlawful and illegal unilateral sanctions.
Iran says he'll considerably step up its remedial measures within the framework of the 2015 nuclear deal in the wake of the recent sabotage at the Natanz uranium enrichment facility. Foreign Ministry spokesman made that announcement in an exclusive interview with Press TV ahead of the next round of talks in Vienna to revive the nuclear agreement. Said Khatibzadeh says that Iran's definitive policies, as stressed by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, will be on the agenda of the country's negotiations. He said that Iran will only cease its remedial measures once U.S. sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled are removed and they are fully verified by Tehran. Khatibzadeh dismissed as a speculation some Western media reports distinguishing between U.S. sanctions and the removal process. Meantime, President Hassan Rouhani says that Tehran wants all parties to the 2015 nuclear deal to honor their commitments that they've made while signing the accord.
In fact, we want the atmosphere and relations to go back to 2015 and that all JCPOA parties realize some pledges and words and accept everything agreed at a time. We are not ready to accept anything less than that, and we do not seek anything more than that.
Rouhani also said that Washington's only option for returning to the deal is its removal of all the anti-Iran sanctions. He was speaking in a meeting with visiting Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who said that the U.S. must come back to the accord unconditionally and fulfill all its commitments. The former U.S. administration unilaterally pulled out of the deal in 2018. Tehran has repeatedly said that Washington must remove all imposed, reimposed, and relabeled sanctions in case it really wants to revive the pact. Now, in other news, Iran has reported a record number of 25,000 new coronavirus infections. The health ministry says that the figure brings the tally to more than 2.11 million. 291 people died of the disease in one day, taking the death toll to more than 65,000. The Iranian government has implemented a 10-day partial lockdown, taking effect in 23 out of the 31 provinces, and that was following a jump in the number of daily infections last week. Non-essential businesses and movie theaters and sporting facilities have been shut down. Gatherings are also limited to only 15 people. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are preparing for the fasting months of Ramadan, and while the Israeli blockade and the coronavirus pandemic have created serious challenges for the population. Ruba Shabat has more.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are preparing for the holy month of Ramadan this year, while many restrictions are imposed by the authorities due to the COVID-19. The coronavirus pandemic has changed how Gazans observe the holy fasting month of Ramadan. There will be no gatherings and ceremonies, and previously busy markets are now quiet as people stay at home amid the pandemic.
The virus is spreading rapidly and there is a significant increase in the number of cases. Religious events must be restricted. People are following the preemptive measures. We hope next Ramadan will be better.
The holy month of Ramadan is an opportunity to go out, meet family, friends, and for night prayer. It is a significant month for Muslims all over the world, as it's the month of fasting, prayers, and community. But the pandemic, for the second year, will affect the celebration of Ramadan.
I'm sad to hear that most religious gathering would be banned due to pandemic, but we have no other choice. This year Ramadan is different for sure, and the circumstances of Gaza is deteriorating day by day.
Gazans are already living in difficult financial conditions and can barely afford their basic needs in this holy month due to the Israeli blockade. Now the coronavirus is a new burden for them as it has doubled their sufferings.
This is the worst time to mark the holy month. Lockdowns and Israeli siege have turned life hard for us. Ramadan is about gathering, and I hope that things will get better for us and the pandemic would be over soon.
Palestinians hope things will remain under control during the holy month, especially that the healthcare system in Gaza cannot handle any major outbreak.
Palestinians here say that the decades-long Israeli blockade is not the only burden this year, and the coronavirus pandemic has made Ramadan ceremonies less cheerful. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
U.S. health authorities have recommended a pause in the use of Johnson & Johnson's single-dose coronavirus vaccine. That's after six recipients developed a rare blood clot. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration says that a recommendation is out of an abundance of caution. All six recipients were women between the ages of 18 and 48. One woman died, and another one has been hospitalized with critical condition. Johnson & Johnson saying that no clear causal relationship has been identified between the blood clot and the vaccine. The pharmaceutical firm said, however, it's working closely with regulators to assess the data. That a move could substantially complicate the U.S. vaccination efforts at a time when many states are struggling with a surge in new cases. Clashes have erupted between police and protesters in Portland as people took to the streets to denounce the latest police killing of an African-American man in Minnesota. According to local media, protesters scattered in front of a building which houses offices for multiple law enforcement agencies. Police declared a riot as the protesters broke some windows, threw projectiles, and tried to enter the building. Anger is boiling, and that has been since a video emerged showing 20-year-old Dante Wright being fatally shot by a white officer while being arrested for a traffic violation. A shooting occurred at a Brooklyn Center near Minneapolis on Sunday. The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has launched an investigation. Russia has accused the United States and other NATO countries of turning Ukraine into a powder keg by increasing arms supplies to the country. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov says the military support is a serious challenge to Russian security. He said that Moscow would do anything possible to ensure its security. Meantime, NATO has called on Russia to withdraw its troops from the Ukrainian eastern border. The alliance claims that's Moscow's biggest buildup since 2014. Russia says it moves its forces around as it sees fit, including for defensive purposes. And this while the U.S. is set to send two warships to the Black Sea this week. Moscow has called the deployment a provocation, warning Washington to ensure its warships stay well away from Crimea for, quote, their own good. China is calling on the U.S. to, quote, stop playing with the fire and the issue of Chinese Taipei. This after Washington eased restrictions on contacts with Taiwanese officials. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman urged the U.S. to immediately stop any form of official contacts with Taipei. Zhao Lijian says that Washington must avoid sending wrong signals to Taiwan in order not to damage Sino-U.S. ties and stability across the region. The spokesman said that China has logged an official complaint to the U.S. on the issue. On Friday, Washington issued guidelines that would enable American officials to meet more freely with officials from the island, what China claims as part of its territory under the One China principle. The U.S. does not recognize China's sovereignty over the Chinese Taipei and keeps selling arms to it. U.S. police in the state of Tennessee have shot dead a high school student after he allegedly opened fire on them.
The Knoxville Police Department received a report of an individual that was possibly armed with a gun at Austin East High School. Upon arrival, officers located the individual in the school in a restroom. They ordered him out, but he refused to comply. As officers entered the space, the subject reportedly fired shots, striking an officer. One officer returned fire. The suspect was pronounced dead at the scene.
The official added that the injured officer is in serious condition after being hit with a bullet in his upper leg. The high school in Knoxville will remain closed for 2 days following the Monday shooting. City officials say that 4 other students at the same school have been shot dead in the past few months. Since mid-March, at least a dozen people have lost their lives in shootings across the U.S. The UN rights chief has warned of possible crimes against humanity in Myanmar, saying that the situation there seems to be heading toward a, quote, full-blown conflict. In a statement, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said that the military intends to intensify crackdown against people using lethal weapons. Michelle Bachelet urged all countries to take immediate action to push Myanmar's military leadership into stopping its campaign of repression and slaughter. Myanmar has been in chaos since February after the military ousted civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi over alleged voter fraud. The junta has since intensified crackdown on anti-coup protesters. According to a monitoring group, over 700 civilians have been killed in protests. South Korea has called unacceptable Japan's decision to release treated water from the wrecked Fukushima nuclear plant into the ocean.
Firstly, the government expresses a strong regret over the Japan's decision to release contaminated water from the Fukushima nuclear station into the sea, and we will take every necessary measure on the principle of putting our people's safety first.
South Korea says the plan is unacceptable and has summoned the Japanese envoy to Seoul in protest. China has also called the decision irresponsible. It says Japan's plan will seriously damage international public health and safety. Under the plan, more than 1 million tons of treated radioactive water stored at the Fukushima plant will be discharged in 2 years. Tokyo says the release is safe because it has been processed to remove almost all radioactive elements and it will be diluted. The Fukushima plant suffered core meltdowns during a devastating quake and tsunami in 2011.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6
6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden might not be building a physical border wall, but he is continuing to expand an infrastructure designed to deter migrants from crossing into the United States. Though he has distanced himself from former President Donald Trump's immigration policy, the Biden administration's plan would see the U.S. government lean into its reliance on technology at the southern border with Mexico, where Customs and Border Protection, CBP, is currently expanding one of the most ambitious surveillance systems ever created. Stay with us for part two of a three-part article written by Will Lennon, under the heading, U.S. Customs and Border Protection Plans Vast Expansion of Technology-Based Surveillance. The article has been taken from truthout.org website. The U.S. federal government is prepared to spend plenty of money on companies willing to work at the southern border with Mexico. Over the past 40 years, the border security budget has grown steadily, from $350 million in 1980 to over $23 billion by 2018. Competition for the funding is fierce. In 2020, 1,452 lobbyists worked on homeland security issues in Washington. 1,390 lobbyists worked on immigration. Anduril Industries has shelled out over $1 million to a lobbying firm called Invariant since 2017. They successfully lobbied Congress to expand the deployment of Anduril Industries' surveillance tower program, and in July 2020, the surveillance towers were declared a program of record. CBP, Customs and Border Protection, already has 60 towers at this point. They aim to have 200 by 2022. In the summer of 2020, Anduril Industries started a contract with Department of Homeland Security worth more than $60 million. The product service code for the contract reads, Construction of Electronic and Communications Facilities. The agreement is an indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity, or IDIQ contract, meaning Department of Homeland Security placed a preliminary baseline order and will have the opportunity to re-up annually until summer of 2025. The IDIQ contract could ultimately be worth up to nearly $250 million and yield 170 surveillance towers for Customs and Border Protection. The two smaller contracts that fall under the IDIQ are for prefabricated tower structures. The first surveillance tower contract has a start date in July of 2020. It shows 37 land surveillance towers and 3 maritime surveillance towers due to be delivered within a year. The second surveillance tower contract is dated September 2020 and consists of 76 surveillance towers along with replacement parts to be delivered within the year. A statement of work says Anduril Industries relies on Amazon Web Service, AWS, to centrally manage application and user access. Anduril Industries is identified in these documents as a small business. Palmer Luckey, one of Andrew Industries' co-founders, is an expert in sensor fusion from his days working in virtual reality. He previously founded the virtual reality gaming company Oculus, where he used sensor fusion to track players' movements, combining data from magnetometers, accelerometers, and gyroscopes. According to Palmer Luckey, Anduril Industries surveillance towers use sensor fusion and artificial intelligence to create a three-dimensional model of large battle spaces. The surveillance towers combine data from radar, visual imaging, and thermal measurements. According to Customs and Border Protection, the towers can also communicate with each other, performing handoffs when something passes from the coverage area of one tower to that of another. Plus, they can spot activity in Mexico when groups might be staging a border incursion. Anduril Industries' ghost drones even gather data from the company's artificial intelligence system, which is called Lattice. At short distances, the ghosts are almost completely silent. A Customs and Border Protection endorsement on Anduril Industries' website describes Lattice as eyes in the back of my head. One border agent explained, once it integrates with a few pieces of technology, it will be completely different than what we've done in the past. Several Customs and Border Protection documents say Anduril Industries is obligated to provide a software development kit and an application programming interface API at the government's request. According to a procurement document, Customs and Border Protection wants technical data for the Lattice system so that the agency will be able to install and incorporate new sensor feeds into the Lattice tower, utilizing existing services and/or infrastructure. A Customs and Border Protection statement of work specifies that any human image labeling has to be done in the United States, and that faces must be blurred before labeling. The same document allows for a vendor to store non-blurred images for training purposes. Vendors are also authorized to use images to train artificial intelligence. According to Jack Paulson, a former Google research scientist who now runs the Technology Inquiry Watchdog Group, Customs and Border Protection could potentially use the Application Programming Interface, API, to go around Anduril Industries software and gather data and images themselves. Jack Paulson said in an interview with Shadowproof, the blurring process could easily be circumvented if one of the application programming interface functions involved sampling from the raw surveillance feed. Customs and Border Protection is authorized to provide data to Department of Homeland Security's agency-wide biometric data management system, also known as HART. HART stands for Homeland Advanced Recognition Technology. Data stored in HART includes fingerprints and facial images, which can be used by the Agency for Facial Recognition. Advanced surveillance systems have been attempted at the border before Anduril Industries, most notably the Boeing-developed Secure Border Initiative, SBINet, project combines sensors and surveillance towers with the aim of reducing illegal immigration. The US government spent $1 billion on the system, which was riddled with bugs, before it was quietly scrapped back in 2011. Although the Boeing-developed Secure Border Initiative, SBINet, failed, experts on migration say that it did have an impact, and it's likely SBINet contributed to a spike in deaths among migrants trying to cross the border by pushing crossers into more deadly terrain. Driving migrants into rugged territory is a strategy the U.S. government has employed for decades. U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Services, INS, a forerunner of Department of Homeland Security, launched a prevention through deterrence strategy back in 1994. One aspect of the strategy was to push migrants from crossing at safe urban nodes of the border, like El Paso and San Diego, towards rougher terrain. Doris Meissner, then the INS commissioner, believed that under prevention through deterrence, geography would be an ally, and that migrants would soon quit trying to make the crossing once they saw how deadly it had become. It became common for the crossing to take days. Migrants often ran out of water and food partway through the trip and were sometimes relieved to be detained by the time Border Patrol caught up with them. A study published in the Journal of Borderland Studies used methods from archaeology and military science to measure how energy is expended by people crossing the border between United States and Mexico. The study then compared those results to records showing the locations of migrant deaths. Researchers found relationships between the enforcement, specifically in the form of SBI net, routes taken by border crossers and fatalities. Avoiding areas where they would likely be intercepted or surveyed often sent migrants into regions where they were more likely to encounter dehydration, hypothermia, injury, and exhaustion. In a 2013 interview, one Border Patrol agent described migrants avoiding the SBI net system. The agent said they'd stayed down in the mountains where it blocked the camera. That was the second part of Will Lennon's article. U.S. Customs and Border Protection plans vast expansion of technology-based surveillance. Tune in tomorrow for the third and concluding part of this series. Until then, goodbye and God bless.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing US Election Day documentary 11-8-16, produced and created by Jeff Deutschman. And joining me in the studio, we have Anna Smith, who is a film critic and broadcaster. She is also the president of the UK Critics Circle and a regular film critic for various mainstream channels. And beside her, we are also joined by Jonathan Fryer, who is a lecturer, broadcaster and freelance writer. Now, on the 8th of November 2016, Americans from all walks of life went to the ballot box to vote for their next president. Though little did they know at the time what would be in store for them, after most people believed that the country would be seeing its first female president be elected. This documentary, which features the work of many directors and film crews, follows a cross-section of Americans throughout that fateful day and shows the complex and diverse spectrum of opinions about their reasons for voting for Trump or for Clinton, or in some cases, not voting at all.
Days to election, I can update this. Did you vote today?
I voted early.
You did? Did it feel great?
Today, I'm going to vote for the first time in almost 30 years.
Good morning, gentlemen.
I'm a little nervous about the outcome of the election, the future for the coal industry.
You can't stop doing politics. Knock on doors, say, hey, excuse me, did you vote today? Be polite. It's a beautiful day.
The election will be over by 9 o'clock. They'll call it by 9:30, and everything will be peaceful and wonderful.
What if it goes the other way?
What? I'm not going to go the other way. No way. Mark it down.
Thank you.
I could feel eyes watching me as I walked through that crowd, like they hated me, like I was Donald Trump.
They say, you know, your vote may make a difference, but to me, I don't think so.
It looks like maybe we should be planning for the too-close-to-call scenario where the Trump wins.
Who we had as president, African-Americans, were still the lowest man on the totem pole.
There's hope. Never forget that the power of the people is stronger than the people in power.
Well, that was the trailer to 11/8/16. First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for both of you for coming on. Now, this documentary could be seen as quite a historic and invaluable piece of filmmaking, as it gives the world viewers an insight, sort of a window into the psyche of Americans voting that day and what they were thinking. And Anna, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
I think you're right that it's an interesting snapshot of Americans, and it also has an emotive subject, a fascinating subject, which all great documentaries need. And what all great documentaries need as well is great characters. And this has lots of really strong characters, people who are voting from different sides, who strongly believe in what they're talking about, and the access to them on a day that is a very important day in their lives means that there's some explosive conversations and some very telling and revealing conversations. So broadly, I liked it.
That's a great opinion. And Jonathan, would you agree with what Anna just said?
Yes, I mean, the technique of the documentary was really interesting. The producers called it a periscope view, with 16 periscopes popping up across all the way from New York over to Hawaii, even interviewing different families and individuals. And of course, it's fascinating because watching it, we know the outcome. But during the film itself, until right at the end, the actual voters are not aware of the outcome. But many of them are really, really engaged, as they either want to Hillary Clinton to win, as what was expected originally, or they're rooting for Trump. And it's fascinating to see how their mood changes, in some cases optimistically, in other way, for other people, disastrously, as they see exactly what they didn't want to happen and literally are brought to tears.
And the dramatic irony of it actually is what makes the film so fascinating and relevant today to watch, actually. And I just want to talk about Jeff Dutchman's previous work. He made a similar film about Obama's election campaign and his supporters. And I bet we can imagine that probably had a different tone than compared to this film. What do you think, Anna?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very different, because of course it's fascinating. He goes about these films without knowing the outcome. But obviously people were much more optimistic about Obama winning, and this was a bit of a surprise result in this case. So it's fascinating to think that when he and all the directors involved, because he sort of curated this, and there were
and
all these other directors.
And what a feat for filmmaking, actually. I wonder how difficult that must have been to coordinate.
Yeah, he sourced a lot of great filmmakers from all over the world who were very talented, and obviously a lot of them probably had connection with their subjects, which gave rise to some very, very interesting people and subjects. But yeah, I mean, just watching it in retrospect then makes it particularly interesting, of course, because there is this sense of perhaps impending doom or success, depending on your point of view, that you just know is going to be a real shock to some people that you're watching. So it adds to the tension.
It was a great collaborative project indeed. And Jonathan, just quickly before we move on, if you could just take us back to that time, why was it so shocking for Trump to win? And in hindsight, is it actually that surprising?
He was an extraordinary candidate and, of course, has become now a very extraordinary president, because he was absolutely not the normal run-of-the-mill politician. Basically, he was anti-politician. And so it was an enormous shock when he was elected. And everyone did expect, most people expected, Hillary Clinton would win. And I'm sure the director was thinking, right, but it didn't happen.
And it was much to everyone's surprise, actually.
So you are in the vast majority of the populace that does not vote. How do you feel about that?
I feel pretty good. More than we are voting for any particular candidate, we are voting for the system. Mm-hmm. And it is a system that I just don't abide by. We don't need new legislation. We don't need a new politician. We don't need the Constitution to change to actually like care for our community. You just have to have the will. That's where I put my effort. I put my effort there because I think change comes from the work that we do, not from the ballot box.
My white people have always had the right to vote, right? Like my lineage has always been, we've been the power, right? So what would you say to somebody who would be like, wait a minute, I'm African American?
You mean like my grandmother?
Yeah, like your grandmother.
As much as I really honor the nothing less than heroics that it took in order for African Americans to be able to vote. You know, getting the right to vote was the equivalent of walking into a room, a game of Monopoly was being played by all rich white men. The game was already in motion, property was already bought, hotels already built, and African Americans earned a right to sit at the table. They earned a right to sit at the table, start in jail, didn't collect $200, start off with no money, no property, nothing. That's a game you cannot win. It's about time that we walk in and wipe the whole damn game off the table and start over.
I think one of the most prominent issues this documentary exposes is the clear racial division in the US. Thinking back to the scene where we see in Chicago African Americans talking amongst themselves sort of the conflict they feel in having to choose between Trump or Clinton, and they say that Clinton obviously isn't the great candidate for them either, considering the whole super predator scandal and the three strikes you're out sort of thing, and then Trump isn't so great on minorities either. Anna, could you just tell us, did this documentary, was it effective in exposing this racial divide and how complicated this issue is?
I think you're right, it is an extremely complicated issue, and it's very hard in the space of a documentary like this, especially with so many different people and so many different directors, to really get to the heart of the issue. But at the same time, it did touch on a lot of that, and it was very careful, I think, to have a variety of people from different sides and of different races talking about how they felt about it. And I thought the filmmakers succeeded in getting people to be very frank about racial issues, as we saw just there, and very articulate. So it was thought-provoking for me on that level.
And Jonathan, would you agree? Do you think this documentary exposed
the divided nation? Well, I think it really stressed the diversity rather than the division, the diversity of the American population, people who've been there for generations, some who are very new immigrants. It's interesting, it starts with a Sikh taxi driver who's clearly from a Punjabi family who've probably very recent immigrants and rather excited by the idea that they will be able to vote. So in that sense, I think it's extremely valuable in showing the different races, ethnicities, religions, etc., that make up the United States. But without a doubt, some people very clearly in the film felt disenfranchised, even if they were able to vote. It's interesting, it ended with a very poor couple in Hawaii living in a tent in a park who basically sort of say, well, you know, okay, it was election, but what sort of difference is it going to make to our lives? Nothing whatsoever.
And I like how it came actually full circle to that point, actually, that some people are very helpless when it comes to politics and it doesn't make a difference to them. So I just want to talk about some statistics now. Data from the election actually shows that the majority of young white Americans, both male and female, under 44 years old, voted for Hillary Clinton, whereas those mostly over 45 overwhelmingly voted for Trump. So Jonathan, why do you think Americans voted the way they did?
Well, there clearly was a very stark generational divide. It's rather interesting, we had a very similar phenomenon here in Britain in 2016 with a EU referendum in which 45 and over majority voted to leave the EU, 44 and younger voted to stay. So there clearly is something happening between the different generations. But what was really also very interesting about the statistics in the US election was that people outside the cities voted for Trump. It was sort of like a rural revolution of people, particularly older people who maybe had seen their hopes dashed for a brighter future and were therefore determined to go out and to make a protest, basically.
Well, we're lucky to have Jonathan here to give us political context to this. I was just quickly wondering, Anna, would you have liked for more political context to these stories?
I think it's also well publicised now that even the most casual observer of the news will know exactly what happened on that day and what the results were and what the ramifications would go on to be for the people that we see on camera. I found it interesting as someone that doesn't necessarily follow every inch of the political news to find out who, you know, the sort of makeup of the voters and the characters of the voters, because, and particularly the Trump voters, because you hear a lot about and see a lot about Trump himself, but to see who actually voted for him and then giving the reasons why, I found fascinating.
And of course, we actually learned that a lot of people who voted for Trump were scared to admit they voted for Trump. So it was only in the aftermath that we really found what was actually happening.
How is it going?
I am working on the next day cartoon at the moment.
Oh, nice.
I'm still making a bold assumption of how this will go.
I think you're safe.
This is the ink drawing, and then
very nice.
Colored in on the computer. Political cartooning is, it's called the jugular art for a good reason. It's almost always negative. So for once, I'm actually being kind of got a positive message here,
yeah,
which may turn out not to be true.
Yeah, we'll see.
But Yeah, it just.
Can you just alter it like somebody like pushing her back through the ceiling or something later?
That would be good. Yeah. Yeah. But I'll get this one out of the way and then see what happens.
I'm glad we got to see the sort of behind the scenes of the media rooms and them preparing for the election result. And they largely believed Clinton was going to win. Anna, what could we learn from the documentary about the role media or social media played in the election?
It was fascinating, wasn't it, that they felt that they kind of knew. I mean, they prepared for every scenario, but there was that confidence in the polls, which evidently was misplaced. So I think a lot of journalists could probably learn from that scenario, from watching that. I certainly found it fascinating watching those journalists there sort of hedging their bets, but basically thinking that Hillary was going to win. In terms of people from all walks of life making assumptions based on what they see and hear. And also when you see people in this documentary watching the results come on screen, on their own TV screens, you just see how sheltered some of those people are on both sides and how little they understand about other people's opinions and how we become, you know, even in social media, we only really follow people with a similar point of view, which isn't, social media is not really explored in this, but I think that's something that's a springboard for thinking about that.
Definitely. And it raises many questions, actually. And Jonathan, if I could put that question to you, what role do you think, actually, the media, indeed social media, played on the election?
Well, there's two different things, the mainstream media and the social media. The mainstream media is clear that most of them, with exceptions such as Fox News, were rooting for Hillary Clinton and firmly expected her to win, though obviously they had to make provision for a result of a different kind. Social media was an entirely different matter because there, the Trumpers, if we can call them that, were really in the ascendant. And this is the first presidential election in the United States where social media had a huge impact. Donald Trump himself has millions of followers, and whereas many people may say a lot of what he tweets about on Twitter is rubbish or untrue, it has a huge effect, and he has that great following. And he, of course, despises the mainstream media, talks about fake news, because the liberal commentators on the LA Times and other newspapers, of course, are opposed to the sorts of things that he believes in and propagates.
And why is it that so many people could believe this, though, that he could label certain news channels fake news and he was so hostile to the press?
Well, we've come into what's called the post-truth world, where it's no longer, what is true that you necessarily accept, but it's what you believe is truth. Mm-hmm. In other words, if it fits in with your own prejudices and your own approach, then that's fine. That's the news and that's what you're going to put forward.
Mm-hmm. And so there's so many interesting questions then that this documentary could raise. Do you think there's any other point and strong themes that this documentary had?
Well, I felt like it could have gone further. It could have shown more Trump supporters, as I said. It could have been more revealing. But in terms of the points it made, for me, characters are such a huge part of it. And to see the dynamic, particularly between one of the husband and wife in Massachusetts, and she's a little bit more reserved about Trump and he's really gung-ho. And to see the difference between families and couples and generations and how they interpret politics and speak to each other about politics, I thought was really, really interesting.
And that's an interesting point, actually, not to defend Trump supporters, but you realise that they're human beings and not all of them are evil, but they have different motivations and grievances for voting in terms of the whole system and their fight, especially when it comes to finances, I think, in the documentary.
A lot of times I work a long day. I'm out of the house before my kids even get out of bed. And then when I come home, it's 6 o'clock at night, it's dark, you know, it's time to eat dinner and go to bed, basically. So if the economy got better and I was bringing more people and more work into my shop and I could delegate a little bit more, then I'd be able to spend more time with my family. That'd be huge. That would be huge for me. I'm doing okay for myself right now, but it would be even that much better, you know? I don't know. I think if when Hillary gets elected, and I think she's going to get elected because she's going to
cheat.
She's going to cheat. She's going to raise the taxes on everybody, and healthcare right now is crushing us anyway. So I'm concerned that we're going to have a tough time making ends meet.
It's not right. And you know Hillary doesn't care about anything but her pockets.
So So this family are quite entertaining to watch. What contribution do you think they made to the documentary?
They brought an entertainment factor, I think, which is really important. There's nothing to say that documentaries about political subjects need to be entirely serious. And it was sort of dark humour, but just seeing the dynamic between them was really involving and entertaining. But it also showed, as I said earlier, that you can, within a couple, see different political views and see different strains and strengths, but also what worrying things that people might be influencing each other and perhaps voting is what they don't personally actually really believe in, they're being swayed.
And Jonathan, would you agree with what Anna said?
Yeah, they were a fascinating family, and they raised two issues there in that clip which are really important. You know, there's tax, because Trump was saying he was going to cut taxes particularly for the higher income earners, which would be attractive to business people. And the other thing was Obamacare. One of the huge things that really figured in the election was the cost of Obamacare. President Obama brought in a system where poor people had medical insurance.
Surely
which
that's
we think
a good
is
thing.
Great, of
Isn't
course.
That akin to
of
the NHS
course, but
that
the Trumpers, on the other hand, were saying we're paying for all these people to do that. But very interesting point made by a number of people during the film is they were voting against someone rather than for someone. And that's why Hillary lost, even though, of course, she actually got more votes than Trump did in the popular vote.
About 2.9% more.
But she was more unpopular than Trump was.
Mm-hmm. And does that expose flaws, then, I suppose, in the American voting system?
Well, to us in Britain, which we don't have a flawless system here either, but it does seem really weird that someone can win the popular vote but lose the presidency.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, and I just wanted to talk about the parallels, actually, between the UK and the US and theatrical aspect of the US. I was just wondering, is there a documentary of this sort that would be as fascinating in the UK as it would be to follow an American election? Do you think it would be as interesting?
Well, obviously, Brexit docs are fascinating, aren't they? I mean, that's the closest thing we've had recently. You're right, though, the Americans do have a showy way about them. But goodness, look at reality TV shows in the UK. We've certainly got our fair share of big personalities. So I think good documentaries can always find them.
Yes. Oh, no, that's a good point, actually. I just wanted to get, Anna, your final thoughts on this documentary, and also would you recommend it?
I don't think it's an earth-shattering documentary, but I think it's very, very interesting. And I think if you want a further insight into what motivated a lot of American people to place their vote a certain way, then it's well worth a watch.
And Jonathan, if I turn to you, your final thoughts on the film,
yeah,
would you recommend it?
When it first started, I thought, oh my goodness, we're going to watch this for an hour and 45 minutes, am I going to really be interested? But you do get interested in the characters, in the individual families. In fact, I was disappointed when it finished.
Mm. And we'll have to leave it there on that good note to end it on. Thanks very much for coming on. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambiati.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BADR 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.